I like that every time before we do the clap, we both put our hands together as if we're going to pray together.
Right? We're just trying to solve a problem like Maria.
Dear Lord, please bless this podcast.
Welcome to Book It,
a bi-weekly podcast where we talk frankly about books. Book It is hosted by the Blue Manatee Literacy Project,
a nonprofit that operates an independent bookstore in Cincinnati, Ohio.
When you shop with Blue Manatee, you are giving back to the community. For every book purchased, BMLP donates a book to a child in need.
Book It is hosted by me, Michael Woodson.
And me, Jill Burkett-Ragacy.
Jill, I have a confession to make. Wow, that worked out too well.
Should I resume my fake podcast prayer?
It's not, the confession isn't that I haven't washed my hair in a week, though that is true. But it looks good, right?
I could tell you that's also what Khloe Kardashian is doing during the pandemic, but maybe I'll just keep that to myself.
Yeah, you've kept that to yourself now. That's how podcasts work.
Yep.
So the other day, I was texting two mutual friends of ours. Their names are Aaron and Sam.
Love them.
And I was, I don't want to say intentionally keeping you off of this thread, but I decided at the last minute not to include you because I wanted to talk to you about this as in person as we can.
I can't wait.
I kind of can. My confession is that I have been rereading something to help me sleep at night.
And no!
Take a guess.
Are you reading Twilight?
So I'm reading Twilight.
Oh, man.
I have a lot of thoughts to start. Ready?
I'm ready.
First, let me say, this is the first time I've reread it since I was 16 or 17. I don't know. Like, right when it first came out.
It's like reading a different book.
It's like reading a completely different book. I know the movie really well. It's because it's a popular one amongst my friends. Watch it all the time. It's a treat. And wow. I like to say that Twilight is my favorite mess, and that continues to be true, because it is
good.
A mess. Yeah.
Yeah.
But let's just, like, talk about this for a second. I completely forgot how terrible Edward and Bella both are.
Yeah, they're garbage.
They're wretched people. Yeah, they're just garbage. And the fact that I completely forgot that he literally sneaks into our bedroom every single night to watch her sleep.
Yeah, it's totally creepy. It's like a groomer. I know.
And we're supposed to think it's like romantic?
Yeah.
It's foul.
Yeah.
But it's also boring.
Okay. But those things can all be true and you can still like it.
Well, here's the thing. I'm actively not liking it. And that actually really surprised me, because I was like, I thought I knew what it was. Like, yeah, it's garbage that I love to read. And I guess that's still true, but that doesn't necessarily mean that I'm liking it. Let me keep going. It is boring. Okay. Uh-huh. I am like 3/4 of the way through and nothing has happened. And not in the way that I love when books end where nothing's happened. But like, when I decide to read a vampire book, I want to read some fucking vampire shit, and this is not it. And I thought, I love Interview with a Vampire. I love True Blood. I love good vampire stuff. Yeah. I always have. So I think that's why when I was 16 or 17, I just like read it. Also because I loved being a part of the conversation. But it's boring. Nothing happens. It is like G-rated vampire.
I don't want to say I told you so, because that feels
you did.
Not nice.
You told me so. Well, and the truth is, I still don't care.
Yeah, absolutely.
Continue to tell me so.
Yeah.
But that part truly really shocked me, how boring it was. And so, like, I'm just like, I intentionally read it at night because I'm just like, well, some people choose melatonin. I choose Twilight.
I love everything about this story. I'm so glad that I didn't know about it before we sat. I'm glad you left me off the text message, because it was better. It was better in person.
And the truth of the matter is, like, I will read all of them. I'm going to reread the rest of them.
Sure. Yeah. Without spoiling too much, I feel like this really perfectly links to a book we're going to discuss later.
Yeah. So why don't you talk a little bit about what this episode's about?
So today's episode is expectation versus reality. And we are going to discuss whether or not book hype as a culture, kind of book culture, is fair. What do authors owe to their readers in a series? And I have finished The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes. Michael's halfway through.
Which is the prequel to The Hunger Games.
We're going to get into it today. I don't know. Yeah. So here's the setup. Michael and I were discussing. I go into every book I read assuming that I will love it. And then when it doesn't meet my expectations, I'm like crushed and sometimes also crabby. And sometimes the book can be okay, but once it hasn't met my expectations, it's dead to me.
It's garbage.
I'm not proud of any of these things, but it is how it is. And Michael has caught on that I finish a book, I post a picture of it on Instagram, and I say, I'm finished with this, and I'm not sure how I feel, which is really Jill code for, I feel really conflicted, and there were things about this that I didn't like and or didn't meet my expectations, but I won't just say that for some reason, which is a longer story. But you don't have that expectation when you read a book, right, Michael?
Right. I think that I'm really bad at, I think it's because I don't try to assume what I'm about to read ever. And that's not intentional. I'm really, Josh always says that I'm like the perfect audience member because everything shocks me. Because I'm always just like, I'm not really thinking ahead at all. I'm always just like on the whatever movie I'm watching or book I'm reading, I'm on like the scene or the page. I'm not thinking ahead at all. So I'm not often I've definitely been disappointed in books, and we've talked about that on this podcast, but I don't know if my expectation necessarily has never been met, because I don't usually have expectations when I read books. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I really like, I'm never like, well, that's not true. If we're talking about Twilight, Breaking Dawn is one of the worst books I have ever read. There's no like irony there. It's just terrible.
Yeah.
But like, I'm not usually like, man, I'm really disappointed at how bad that was. And there's a couple of exceptions, but I think that I'm usually just like game for whatever page I'm on. So I think I go, I'm along with the ride.
Yeah. You
know? Yeah. I don't know. It's hard to explain, but I think we're different readers, and our reading experiences are very different, but I think we're similar in that our love of reading doesn't depend on whether or not we ended up loving the book. We just love to read. So like,
yeah,
even if we hated the book, it's okay. Like, it gives us something to talk about.
Absolutely. Yeah. I don't necessarily mind having read a book I didn't enjoy.
Totally.
Especially if it's enjoyment or not enjoyment is something that can be discussed. It's not just like,
exactly,
how often do you read a book where you just flat out hated it and there's like nothing to even discuss about that? I mean, that I can't think, well, I almost said I can't think of a book like that, and now I just have.
Tell me.
Oh, the terrible play that became a book for the Harry Potter series. Mm-hmm. I mean, that book is just terrible, and I'm mad I spent any time on it.
Exactly. Okay, that is the difference, because I do think that just saying you hate... Oh, this is actually another episode that we can go into some other time, but I do think when people say I hated it and then don't spend some time on why, that's not the best kind of reader. Like, I think it's important to know why you didn't like something that you just participated in. Though, I agree. I do not have the patience to talk about how bad Harry Potter and the Cursed Child. Is that what it was?
Yes. No, that book in particular, I feel like crosses this line where I'm mad that I spent any time on it.
Totally.
I can dislike something or say this isn't for me, or these are the problems I have with it, or this is why I think this book is problematic.
Yeah.
And it's different from how did this garbage get published? I want my hour and a half back.
Exactly. And when the hype doesn't live up to that's when hype really pisses me off, because the reviews for Cursed Child were like, a lot of what I saw was really lovely reviews, like really good reviews. And then I read it and I was just like, this is bad. And I think that also it's like, people also say like, well, it's actually like so good when you see it live, like you need to go see it live. And it's like, then don't publish the script. Like, I've participated in reading the script. I can't go see it. So, like, in just reading it, this was terrible.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I agree on all of that.
But I do for you, I feel for you, that you go into every single book being like, I know that this is going to be the best thing I've ever read. And then you walk away from it and you're like, I'm going to throw this out the window and I'm in the worst mood of my life.
Yes.
let's unpack that.
Okay. So here is part of it. And part of it does have to do with the marketing and the hype. And I think it is really challenging when your job, I mean, aside from being, you know, this clearly world famous podcaster with you.
World famous. We do have some listeners in Istanbul or something. I saw on Audioboom.
Hello, Istanbul. aside from this, you know, my day job is being the book buyer for the Literacy Project. And so I see so much of what gets published. I meet with the sales reps and decide what we're going to bring into the store. And so I read a lot through the lens of evaluating something for purchase, which definitely impacts my reading. But when the marketing and the salespeople position a book in a certain way, I sort of feel like I have to take them at their word.
Yeah.
Of how they're positioning it in the market, because that's their job. And I think part of what trips me up sometimes is I'm like, look, this is a perfectly fine book, but let's talk about what you've comped it to. This book is not in the same stratosphere with what you've comped it to.
And sometimes they're spot on. So I think that's when they're wrong, it feels really like manipulative.
Yes.
Like, we recently interviewed Renee Watson, and they were comparing her new book, Ways to Make Sunshine, to Ramona Quimby. And that was like perfect.
Oh, I feel that was a totally fair comp. Yes.
Yeah.
And I went into it a little bit suspicious because I feel like Beverly Cleary occupies a certain place in the canon of children's literature. And I was like, look, if you're going to say you're the next coming of Beverly Cleary, like, you need to
better
bring
be able
it.
To back it up. Yeah.
And she did.
Yeah.
That was a great book. It's a great entry in the market. I felt like that was, that was well placed. As another example, almost every picture book that is meant to be tongue-in-cheek humor for the fall has been comped to We Don't Eat Our Classmates, which was hugely popular last year. Bestseller. Yeah. It's probably, aside from Aaron's book, it's one of the biggest sellers we have in an individual title format.
Aaron's book, which is Mr. Pumpkin's Tea Party.
Yes, Mr. Pumpkin's Tea Party. I don't for a second believe that almost every single funny picture book that's coming out this fall should be comped to that title.
And do you even think that's helpful?
I guess it depends on how you're using a comp. I like to use a comp as like an indicator of the genre and the tone.
Sure.
And the level of humor. And also where you think it's going to fall in the market. Like, do you think this is going to be a one runaway bestseller? Do you think this is going to be a quiet hand sell that comes up from the bottom? Like, what as a publisher, where do you place this and how do you see its life as a book? But sometimes I feel like they're just comping everything to anything that's popular.
Right.
And be like, oh, it's this season's We Don't Eat Our Classmates. And I'm like, but is it?
Right. And well, and to your point, like every popular series that's like the aftermath of a popular series, like any remotely fantasy book after Harry Potter was comped to Harry Potter.
Right.
Every single remotely dystopian book was comped to The Hunger Games.
Absolutely.
And then I think that makes me curious about The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes, because the result of The Hunger Games was just like dystopian novel after dystopian novel after dystopian novel, and then it petered out, and then we're back with The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes, which may also play into expectations versus reality, because there was a little bit of dystopian fatigue.
Yeah.
you know? Oh, and then
we sort of are living in a dystopia.
Oh, maybe we shouldn't have. Yeah, this is awful. This is awful is the prequel to NBC's This Is Us. Yes. or the dystopian version of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it makes me curious about, so thinking about that, like you said, you just recently finished The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes, and you had very conflicting feelings about it. You and I have not talked about this yet. I'm really interested in your take, because I am only about halfway through right now.
Yes. So I will say, I don't think anything that I'm going to say has a spoiler, but okay. We are going to discuss The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes. And so as a listener, if you have not read it, decide whether or not you want to hear this.
Maybe Jamie can put in like a spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert, spoiler alert, spoiler alert. Okay, so I want to lead with, I did not hate this book. And please hear everything I say through a lens of, I'm not saying I hated it. I'm saying it's more complex than liking or not liking it.
Perfect.
So in the first series, in the original series, the Hunger Games trilogy, something that just kind of always bugged me was the world building. Because it operates on the mm-hmm. premise that like cameras mm-hmm. record your every move and they're really omnipresent but invisible. And like I'm kind of sitting there going like, how does that work? What power controls them? Who monitors mm-hmm. them? Like, how did they get there? And this kind of ever-present society, when you look at the different districts, of how can a society that's capable of producing some of the surveillance and oppression equipment and policy be so technically backwards in so many other ways? And before you even get to that, how in the world did these hardscrabble districts, which have always been poor and oppressed, manage to get the equipment required to carpet bomb the Capitol for the number of years that we've been told that went on? Because this isn't, and especially in Songbirds and Snakes, is not presented as like how in modern warfare we think of rebels kind of targeting very specific areas and kind of, I mean, this is really set up as if there was a sustained, constant bombing. Like, I mean, I kind of likened it in my head to like World War II when Germany was
right.
bombing Britain every single night. It's really how it's presented in this book. And I'm a little bit like, well, I just don't feel like the pieces are all there in the world building that kind of held all of that together.
Like to back it up.
Yes. But yeah. In the first trilogy, I kind of told myself, none of this matters. It's a post-war society, and right. the world we are given is what's left of the former time. And maybe I don't understand that, but it's not relevant to now. But that whole era deeply informs President Snow's childhood and teenage years and his upbringing. Mm-hmm. And it makes no more sense now than it did then.
Beforehand, yeah.
Yes. And so I think I expected an answer to some of these questions, or at least a more nuanced presentation of them. And that, I think, is lacking as a whole.
So in this criticism of it so far, it's less about Snow's character necessarily, and just like the like you said, the details of the world. Like, how did this possibly happen? And then, to your point, I think in reading the first trilogy or the original trilogy, it doesn't really matter because it is post-war. And mm-hmm. it's also like maybe the thing that's most important is the way we're treating each other. But then if we're selling a prequel in a way that tells us we're going to better understand how we got here. And then you're saying like it didn't really make it. It didn't explore that any more than it did in the original trilogy. I think that's a totally fair criticism.
Yeah. So that's a starter. And I think that's kind of an easier issue to discuss. And I also think there is a whole swath of readers for whom that criticism of the book doesn't matter.
Sure.
And I 100% get that. You know, they can just accept, you know, it is what it is and I'm enjoying the story. And there's great benefit to that. And so I don't want to.
Whatever. But you're allowed to feel how you feel about it.
Right.
Yeah.
But
this is your podcast, Jill.
Thank you.
Give Istanbul what they want.
But more than this, it was, handling the exploration of nature versus nurture and basically how do you grow an evil dictator. And obviously, that's the theme. That's what we're doing here, sure, in this book. But it was so overly blunt and in your face to the point where the theme interfered with the narrative. I mean, this novel is, wow, a plinth for two opposing worldviews. And the family that straddles both worlds is literally named Plinth. Stop.
So thanks for listening. Follow us on Instagram.
It's
heavy-handed.
It is super heavy-handed. And it felt like an exercise in excusing Snow or presenting a narrative that said this is the only way this could have turned out and there were no alternatives. And I don't think that was actually Colin's intention. And, you know, I think when you, sure, look at his friend and Lucy Gray, they were supposed to show us that this could have gone so very differently. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, I did not believe Collins in that presentation. She did not sell me that Snow ever really considered being anyone than who he was in the original series. And he spent the entirety of this book denying that his friend was even his friend. He always viewed him as someone he could use. And it was the same with Lucy Gray. Right. I don't believe the premise, and then she beats you over the head with the theme.
So in regards to this episode, mm-hmm, how much of that is her fault and how much of that is the reader's fault? Yes. Do you think?
So, and I realize that some of this is Scholastic and not Suzanne Collins. So I want to be clear, sure, that I understand that.
Yeah, fuck you, Suzanne Collins. Just kidding. No, please don't add that. I love you.
Wow. I think that Scholastic definitely positioned this book as we're going to... That Jon Snow... or not Jon Snow. President Snow is the protagonist, and he's not a hero. And they said that from the start, and I agree, yeah, that is correct positioning of this book. I do think it was Suzanne Collins' intention to really have a thoughtful look at nature versus nurture and, mm-hmm, how you end up where you were. I think that was her intention, and I don't think she delivered.
Okay. Can I respond?
Yeah, please do.
I have two responses here. One is in favor of your critique, and one is in favor of the book.
Do it.
Let's start with, to defend the book a little bit, it is young adult. So I think that heavy-handedness kind of goes hand-in-hand sometimes with YA books, is what I experience in reading them. I think it's there's not a lot of subtlety, and that's not a criticism necessarily, but it's just like, okay, we're going to be fairly blatant with what we're trying to do here, especially with genre books. So that so far hasn't bothered me, but again, I'm truly only halfway through. I think it is totally fair to say, in defense of your critique, that I think part of that is that Suzanne Collins has never been great at pacing. And so I think that in trying to, there's just no time. She also sets it up where there is no time to explore subtlety because things happen so quickly. So it's like, instead of letting things happen, maybe in a more natural sense, to your point, she bangs you over the head with it because there's just no time. And I think especially when, I don't think there's going to be, I think this is just a standalone, right?
That's my understanding.
Since it's not going to have a follow-up in any way, it's like, maybe a little bit of insecurity there where it's like, I better make sure they understand this. It's like, we understand it. Like, move on. Or maybe just like, don't tell me so aggressively over and over again. Because that truly is a criticism and I love The Hunger Games. That was a criticism I had in reading the original trilogy, was that she didn't always trust the reader to get it. Like, she just really, I think, was fearful of not telling enough. So she told too much. And in regards to Snow, if he isn't a hero, I never want him. I think there's some, I was prepared to completely dislike him, and at the and I still don't like him, but I liked the perspective of being very omniscient, and the narration a lot of the time does let him just be a monster. But I'm not loving moments where I'm supposed to like feel anything for him because he is a monster. I mean, like, there's a moment in the book where I got, and I don't want to say too much, but you and I can talk about it later, where
Lucy Gray does. I've already spoiler alerted this conversation, so you can say.
Okay.
It.
Lucy Gray is singing at her, like,
the interview?
Yeah, the interview. Mm-hmm. And everyone loves it, and everyone's applauding her. And that chapter ends with Snow saying that he just felt jealous over everything else. And I was like, yes, this is Snow. Like, he hates that she has the limelight. He's jealous of that. He's a monster. But then it was really just like, he's jealous because the song was about some boy she loves in District 12. And I was just like, please don't do that. Like, this doesn't have to be about love or like falling in love with her. Like, this can be like Snow trying to like survive no matter how much, any way he can. And so when someone else is taking the limelight away from him, he sees that as a threat. I was really prepared for that narrative. And then it quickly turned into like another love story.
So the love story is the next note I have. And the love story really bothers me. Mm-hmm. The Stockholm syndrome-esque aspect of identifying with and falling in love with your captor, and then not exploring that there's legitimately no possible way that this is a deep and meaningful relationship was so abhorrent to me.
Me too. So far.
That really bothered me. And I feel like it's representative of a couple of things that kind of bother me as a feminist about this book series. There's this way that, like, do you remember from reading the series the first time? Like, Katniss had to be secretly pretty. Like, she was always just this plain and meek girl. And then when it was time to, like, film a Prabo or make a public appearance, she's, like, all dolled up. But that's not who she really is. And when she's at home, she's just, like, this devoted sister. And she's only, like, a ruthless, like, fierce person when she's like dropped in an arena and forced to be, as if like there couldn't be any aspects of her personality like that to start with.
Sure.
And I think in the original book, not until we meet President Coin, who is evil, do we meet an ambitious woman in these books. And she's not just a like good a person,
like an unapologetically ambitious woman.
Yes. And then in this prequel, it's the doctor. What's her name? Dr. Gall?
Yeah, but she's a monster.
Right. But that's my point. And Lucy Gray, same thing. She's not. I mean, she couldn't hurt a fly. She's a nice person who entertains people. Where are the powerful, fierce women in these books? What is happening here? They're all like weird. The only ones who have any ambition or power are evil or crazy. And any ones who take initiative to do anything for themselves, it's not because they are inherently that person. It's that the circumstances have forced them to become that person. But who they really are family-loving people pleasers.
Yeah, it's like the Joannas of the stories are few and far between.
Yes. 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 And it bothers me. And I feel like in this one, this whole love story is the story of a captor and her captive. And I just, and we act like that's not happening. In the same right. way when you talked about the Twilight book earlier, like, you know,
my favorite mess.
Yeah. He's watching her sleep every night.
And it's supposed to be romantic.
And it's, yes. And it's not. And I never felt that way about it. And so when you try to say, you know, it could have gone differently, I'm like, no, not really. This is another power dynamic in which he was not actually expressing any deeper meaningful feelings.
And that maybe that's also, she spends too much time telling us something that we already know and then is too subtle in other ways. So maybe that's you know how they say, like, in the Harry Potter world, Harry's parents and, like, Ron's parents and stuff married really young, mm-hmm. and kind of probably really quickly because they were in the middle of a war and they didn't know if they were going to live. That feels very significant and real because they're really young parents. I think Harry's parents got married when they were, like, 19 or something. Mm-hmm. And I can see a reality with the Hunger Games where that could also be true, because if they were in war for so long, maybe they think they're feeling certain things because they feel like there's just not enough time to, like, question it. It's like, oh, I have, like, I think I, this is probably a crush, and, like, our situation is, like, heightening that. I think I definitely love this person, but there's not, to your point, there's not enough nuance and there's not enough subtlety there for that to be true. That's just me, like, reaching for this not to be such a problem.
Well, I mean, all of this said, I didn't hate this book. It was fun.
I like reading it.
I wanted it to be so much more than it was. And in preparing for today's episode, I kind of went through and read some of the reviews. And the Slate review of this book had such a great line. And the reviewer said, the books make no political or sociological sense, but their emotional coherence is bulletproof. And I was like, yes, something emotionally about these books is hitting people. Right. And I think it's kind of that it's always like an underdog story and you kind of want to root for them. But the rest of it does not make any sense. And this, again, is a sentence in a glowing review of this book.
Hmm.
The best parts for me were the crisp, action-packed descriptions in the arena during the Hunger Games. Colin shines there. The rest of it was fine to problematic for me.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, what does she owe us? Are my expectations fair?
It's a really good question, and it's something that I think that we will never know the answer to, because so much goes into selling a book now that defines our expectations. I think that any book, like, if you think about Indie Next List, mm-hmm. my expectation for that is that is an amazing book that indies love, and I trust indies, and, like, they can't be wrong. And sometimes when I read a book from Indie Next List, it's just okay, or it's garbage, or it's lovely, but it's truly just opinion. But my expectation is that these are book people who love this book, so I'll probably love it. And then there's the opposite side of it, where it's a huge release, The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes, and they have to work really hard to sell it, but they also, there's a lot of pressure on it. So it's like they either stay quiet and it sells like crazy, or they prepare people for what they're about to read. Because I think a lot of people had a problem with Snow being the main character. I was like, when it was released that the book was coming out, I was like, yes, I loved The Hunger Games. This feels appropriate. I don't love always when there's a prequel. I like when series end. Mm-hmm. But I was like, cool, I'm into this. And then it said, like, President Snow was the main character. I was like, I don't give a shit about President Snow. Like, yeah. Give me something else. But then they were really quick to be like, he's not a hero. So then I was like, oh, okay. Like,
yeah,
I'm interested. So then, again, I'm not disliking it that much. I definitely don't love it. But I think that's a place where our expectations were probably what they wanted them to be. And then we're being let down by them.
Yeah, I think in this specific example, my expectations are pretty fair.
I think so, too.
I was expecting a story with a protagonist and not a hero. And I was expecting basically, like, how do you make an evil dictator? Like, how do you end up in this situation? So that's the book I was expecting. I feel like that's the book I read. I just thought it wasn't that great.
Totally.
But that said, it wasn't bad, and it was really fun. And I would also say that a lot of the issues I've had with it, as we've discussed, were things that bothered me about the original trilogy, which I also still like.
Me too, yeah. And I think that those are really good adaptations. Like, mm-hmm. the books, like I said, like, pacing isn't her strong suit because things happen so quickly. I think she gets away with a lot of things that other authors wouldn't necessarily get away from, because she sets that up immediately. Like, this is going to move really quickly. The pacing is wild.
Yeah.
Like, hold on to your hats. So then when the movies came out, they got to slow down. They sort of delved into things a little bit deeper. She wrote the screenplay for the first movie. So I think that's why they translate really well, is because there was like there are moments of emotion that could be slowed down. I think that if we're talking about just expectations versus reality in general, I think any author who finds success, we're immediately putting our expectations on what they're going to do next. Absolutely. And I think that I don't want to keep talking about Harry Potter because J.K. Rowling's kind of a monster now, but like the first book that J.K. Rowling wrote after her, or I published after Harry Potter, was The Casual Vacancy.
Yes.
Which was very different than Harry Potter. And immediately we were told that, like, this isn't a Harry Potter story. This is a book for adults. And it's about local council, local government.
Is that the one she wrote under a pseudonym?
Yeah, so we'll get there.
Okay.
And when the book came out, I was really excited about it. I took a independent study comparing her writing style in The Deathly Hallows directly to The Casual Vacancy. Like, how has her writing changed between the two? And so I think that my expectations were equal parts, maybe unfair, but also because I had a professor who like was really, really, really brilliant, got me to a point where it's like, we're going to talk about how this is different, like how it's not the same. So don't expect it to be the same. So I loved that book. I mean, I thought it was, really well written. I think it's technically some of her best writing.
Ooh.
I totally agree that some of it is wildly heavy-handed and a little out there, but I think that it was really unfair of people to think that it was going to be Harry Potter or like as exciting as Harry Potter, because everyone's criticism of it is that it's just boring. Yeah. It's like if you directly compare it to Harry Potter, yeah, it is a dirge, but it's not. Like if you just have the wrong expectations, and I don't think there was anything anybody could have done that could have changed people's expectations for whatever she did next.
Yeah, that's an interesting juxtaposition between the two.
And someone else who I think found a lot of slow rise to fame but then was wildly popular there for a couple of years was John Green, especially in the YA world. And I think after, what was it, what did he write right before The Fault in Our Stars?
Oh, I'm bad about knowing the order.
Me too. Especially his. They've been out for forever.
I know. Let's see. Okay, so Looking for Alaska was his first book,
which I love to this day.
I love Looking for Alaska. He also has An Abundance of Catherines, which I feel like people say they don't like, but I loved.
I never read that one.
It has some math in it, which is why I think it turns readers off. But I would gently push back and say, actually understanding any of the math, it is not pursuant to the point of the book.
Sure.
He has Paper Towns.
Mm. He has Will Grayson. Will Grayson, he wrote with John Leviathan.
Yes.
Whatever. I can't remember
what came
right before.
Yeah, The Fault in Our Stars and then Turtles All the Way Down, which is my least favorite.
Me too. And I think that The Fault in Our Stars was such a massive hit. I mean, yeah. It was like far and wide his most popular book. I don't love it. I think it's wildly heavy-handed and saccharine.
Yes, that book always surprises me because I don't think it's his best. It became this huge runaway cultural phenomenon. Yep. I'm glad it introduced readers to his other books that I think are better.
Yes. But same.
I also like that he's really upfront and he says nothing I do after this will ever be that.
Z-snap.
But, you know, I mean, like, how do you make something be a cultural phenomenon? Like, you just can't.
Right. And, like, it was so personal to him. If you know the story behind The Fault in Our Stars, like, it was a story he felt like he had to write. I think that's fine. I think that there's a lot of, like, emotionally manipulative things in that book that make it a little bit easier to say, like, it was successful because it asked me to cry a lot, and so I did. Didn't ask me to cry, didn't try very hard at making me cry. Like, you put a dying teenager in a book, I'm probably going to cry.
Right.
But I think that regardless of how I felt about it, the expectations for his next book were astronomical.
Yeah.
So then when Turtles All the Way Down came out, I think it was kind of not nearly as heartbreaking as The Cursed Child, but a lot of the reviews were glowing. People loved it. It was an important topic. And then when I read it, it just felt like it skimmed the surface. Like it kept almost being what it promised it would be.
That is my read on it too. It was like, this book is almost there.
Yes. And that's what I like John Green a lot, but I think that the difference between, he writes a very different teenager than the teenagers I know and the teenager I was. Like, I was nowhere near as beautifully spoken or smart as the teenagers in his books. Sorry. So that part is a little bit, I have to like suspend disbelief in that way. And I always forget that even within realistic fiction for teenagers, there's a lot of suspension of disbelief because they just are beautifully well-spoken 16-year-olds. And I'm just like, you wouldn't be, but right. Go for it. Isn't there a quote by John Green?
Did you already say it? No. So I come back to this quote a lot because I just think John Green is just such an interesting person. I follow along. I listen to his podcast and follow along with his vlogs and stuff and some of the other things he does. But he has this quote and he says, you know, books belong to their readers, which is a great thing because books are more powerful in the hands of the readers than they ever could be in my hands. Hmm. And I was running that around because he says, you know, people often ask him what happened to Hazel and I've forgotten the boy's name.
Oh, I can't remember.
I can't remember. And, you know, like at the end of the book or what's going on with the author and like what really happened. And he's like, yeah, you tell me because the story I was telling is out there. This is what I had to say. And so in preparing for this episode, I went back and looked at some of like the FAQs on his website. And there was this question in the reading materials for Looking for Alaska, where he was like, you know, like, are these two people meant to be in a relationship? You know, like, what is happening here, like, in the closing scene, like, at the end? And he's like, yeah, so here's the thing. I wrote this book a long time ago. And I remember there being a moment at the end, but maybe not. And it could really be one of like four things. One, I wrote it and cut it out later. Or two, I never wrote it and I imagined it. Or three, I never wrote it or imagined it, but I saw it in a movie script when they, you know, made it into a movie and I liked it. And now that's what it is in my head. Or I read it in a fan fiction. But either way, any of those things, it doesn't matter because the text of the novel is what it is. That is the story I was telling. And what you bring to it is what matters and what it means to you and what you get from it. I always read with that in the back of my mind because I'm like, you know what? My reading of this is going to be different than anybody else's reading of it. And it's going to mean different things to different people. And it's going to be seen in different shades by any person who reads it.
I think that's what makes him such a good writer is not even just what he's putting on the page, but the conversations and his reflections around it with his readers. I think that because I went to a talk of his. He came to Cincinnati. Gosh, I was still in college, so this was a while ago, but he was so lovely. He took way more time than he needed to answering our personal questions, not just what he was there for. And then he stayed forever to sign books. And when he told me he loved my hair when he signed my book, and I was like, thanks. But I really appreciate that he seems really logical about the difference between the writing process and the reading process. They are very different. Mm-hmm. So like he does his job and then part of his job is letting go and he does that. And then to your point, like, and to his point, it kind of doesn't matter. Like we can ask him as much. This is why English classes exist. I mean, it's for these conversations. Like if we had an answer, I don't think read books would ever be as powerful as they are.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Maybe it doesn't matter what expectation versus reality is.
I think that's why my expectations are usually neither met nor disappointed because like, I don't know if it matters. Like I don't love reading like I said this earlier, I don't love reading because I love good books. I love reading because I love reading and I love talking about them. Like, I very rarely feel like I wasted my time when I didn't love a book or a movie or a a show is different. When a show is bad, I spent my year watching it. Don't do that to me.
Right.
But with books, I'm just like, no, I like knowing why I don't like a book. Mm-hmm. And I'm never going to, like, hate reading a bad book. Though, I will say, there is a difference between when... I think we're talking a lot about books that from authors that we've already read. Mm-hmm. There's a different... It's a different flavor when an expectation isn't met with a book from an author who you're reading for the first time. Because then it's like, well, I'm never going to read something of theirs again. That's maybe my least favorite moment of expectation versus reality. And we've talked about this before, but not for very long. And the last time that I was really disappointed, my expectation was really not met with with a book that I was reading from an author for the first time was Eligible by Curtis Sittenfeld.
Yeah.
Because that was like the first Curtis Sittenfeld book I'd ever read. Wildly popular. Pretty well praised. It was like one of Reese's first like book club books or whatever.
Yeah.
And I love Pride and Prejudice. It was a modern retelling of Pride and Prejudice. And then I read it and was just like underwhelmed and deeply offended by it.
Yeah. So you and I discussed earlier when we talked about adaptations that Eligible was one that neither of us enjoyed. And it was like you, I went into it expecting to like it. I had read Sisterland and American Wife and loved them both and thought that I would enjoy this book and I like the source material. So it was kind of set up as here is a book that you will like. You like all the things adjacent to it. And then I did not like it. I felt like it was, I think we talked about this, like the way all of the brands and the streets and everything were like dropped in, it felt like Clueless, but like a bad take on Clueless. Right. And so I am really hesitant to have any feelings about, I want to read Rodham.
Me too.
Which just came out last month. It is in my to be read pile, but I don't know what expectations to have.
I don't either.
Because like I loved Sisterland. I loved American Wife. I did not enjoy Eligible and I didn't like The Man of My Dreams. So we're even. We're two on each side. What is it going to be?
And your perspective, I think, is way more fair than mine, where I'm just like, fuck Curtis Sittenfeld. But I've only read one book where I'm just like, this was terrible. Like, why did everybody talk about it? But I, too, I'm like, it's frustrating thing because she's technically writing things that I'm really interested in.
Yeah.
But I also think it's wildly manipulative, or I feel manipulated because she's has her finger on the pulse of what's going on right now.
Yeah.
So, like, Rodham is essentially fan fiction. I mean, like, it's literary fan fiction, but, like, sorry, I don't find her to be particularly literary, which is part of my problem, is that we talk about her as if she's just this, like, profound writer with these really profound ideas, and I don't find her to be so once I go to her writing. Because then she recently came out with, God, I'm really just like, whatever. I hope she never hears this because I think maybe she's a lovely person. But like, she came out with a collection of short stories a couple years ago. Mm-hmm. And again, it had like rave reviews. And I was like, okay, let me try again. So I went to the bookstore and I read like the first couple of pages of the first story. And it just was like not sitting with me at all. So then I just said, like, maybe she's just not my writer. Like, it's not that she's bad or good. She's just not for me. And I think that that's the part that's hardest for me to remember is when I don't like a book, it doesn't mean that it's a bad book necessarily. Yeah. It just means that it's just not for me.
Yeah, I feel on the fence. I And part of it is I can't figure out what it is. Like, what is the difference between what I have liked and what I haven't? I haven't spent enough time delving into to what I like and not like there.
Sure.
I am... We're going to talk about book covers on another episode, so I don't want to go too far down this rabbit hole, but part of what is intriguing to me about the cover of Rodham is that I feel like they have purposefully chosen an unflattering photo.
Hmm.
And I want to know what that says about the contents. And I want to know whether or not it is commenting on our kind of societies. It is so hard to be a professional woman in the spotlight in America, in the world. I mean, you have to look a certain way before anyone will listen to what you have to say. And I feel like that's so much of the criticism pushback on her is based entirely on her gender. So I want to know how this cover plays into what is inside.
That's a really good point. And
it is adding to my expectation. I don't want to be disappointed.
But is that self-inflicted expectation?
I don't know.
I don't either. I mean, that's a really good point. And I think that perspective, especially since it's political, I mean, if we're talking about, since you had mentioned that with the Hunger Games, the idea of like, where are the powerful and what did you say about the women in Hunger Games?
They're ambitious.
The ambitious, powerful, ambitious yes. women. Where are they? And here they are. And we're writing, we have to write fan fiction about them because we've totally deteriorated their careers and their lives.
No.
We're terrible.
We are. No, you have a point.
But I am curious, like, in the same sense that I was saying, like, the first book I read by Curtis Sittenfeld, Eligible, was the first book I read by hers. My expectations were wildly high, were wildly not met. Mm-hmm. Can you think of a writer's book that you read, which was the first book of theirs that you read, that then you were like, why does everybody love this?
You're going to get mad at me. So I had read, Do You Know It's Coming?
Yes.
Yes. Have you purposely set me up? I feel like I'm being set up. I had read Jacqueline Woodson's picture books. We interviewed her for the podcast. I had not read any of her adult books, which is like a failing. I picked up Red to the Bone as the first book. Now, it is the one I ordered and it got to my house. And Michael said, it's not my favorite. I like these other ones better, but it's what I had. And I was like, we're plunging ahead. I read the book. I do have a more nuanced view of it, having spoken to her and kind of reflected on it quite a bit. But my initial reaction, which I said when we recorded the episode to Michael...
Yeah.
I finished the book at 2:00 in the morning and I sent him a DM on Instagram and I was like, I hate the main character. Is it Iris?
Yeah.
I don't like her. And I'm not sure what I think about this book. And I love all of her children's books, the picture books and Brown Girl Drew. Like, I love those so much more than this.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt terrible because I know you love her.
Well, I woke up to it and I turned to Josh. I was like, I told her not to read this one.
You did. And so since then, I went and got Another Brooklyn after we talked about it. Yes. And I read that last weekend and I loved that one so much more. So I'm on board now. And
I didn't know you read Another Brooklyn.
I did. Yes. Well, because I thought... I mean, you love her to the point where when we talked to her and you were telling her about what her writing meant to you, it made you cry. And I thought...
Thank you, yes.
I'm missing something. Oh. And I want to see what Michael sees and I want to get that. And she's amazing and everyone loves her. Like, I was like, I'm coming at this wrong. Like, this can't be... And... I will say I loved that book. And also in talking to her and talking to you and reading about Red at the Bone a little bit more, I do have a kind of wider, more nuanced feeling about it. And there are things about it, which we touched on briefly. I mean, there are not a lot of feminist explorations of motherhood in fiction that is widely read. You do not see an empathetic look on a mother who has abandoned her family in other fiction books. Like, that's just not a place that I think we allow women to go. And so that part of it, I wholesale changed my mind about, because initially I was like, she's a garbage person. And then I was like, but anyway, to your point, when I read it, it was like, I don't get it. Now, I don't feel that way anymore. But my initial response was very much, I don't get it.
But that's also like a difficult place to get, is where that doesn't necessarily mean you have to like it any more than you. It doesn't mean you have to like it or not like it any more or less. It just means that you understand it now, but you can still not have liked it. You know what I mean?
Like,
which is kind of, I think what you're saying is like, I do get it now. I don't think I need to read it ever again, but like, I understand it better than I thought I did.
Yes.
Which, and maybe you shouldn't be reading books at 2 in the morning.
Other books that I did genuinely like.
For sure. Which we've talked about even before we recorded the podcast with her.
Yeah.
But I also think that, like, what I love about our friendship and this podcast is that you and I are very different readers, and things connect with me that maybe won't connect with you, and vice versa. But I also think that means like our life experiences are pretty different.
Absolutely.
I think bottom line is that whether or not our expectations are met or not, it maybe doesn't always matter, because the conversations we have about the books themselves are, I think, what is most important. And that's, I think, why book clubs are so fun. You come with all these different perspectives. I think that's why what we do is so fun, why Blue Manatee is so important to me, because I don't need everybody to agree with me. I just want them to talk about the thing that I just want people to talk about the book with me.
I agree. Yeah. And it's hard because there's never going to be a situation in which we aren't set up with some kind of expectation. So wanting,
exactly.
I mean, every once in a while it'll be like, I picked this book up and I knew nothing about it. But for you and I, that is almost never going to be the case. And exactly. So you just kind of have to accept that the expectation exists and figure out how to live with it.
I think that, and we're wrapping this up, but I think that that is the difference, is the only time when something exceeds my expectations is when I really don't know anything about it. Mm-hmm. And that was my experience with Another Brooklyn. I saw it in a bookstore. I was like, oh, I've been meaning to read this. I didn't really know what it was about. And then it blew my mind and I fell in love with the writer. Mm-hmm. I had no expectations. I just knew, I was like, oh, this, I'm going to check this one out. And so I think maybe learning to be that open-minded generally is something to remember, but fat chance of that. Sorry. If you tell me Snow's not a hero, I don't want him to fall in love with the main character.
I don't think he did.
I wanted him to be jealous that she had the limelight, not because some boy loved her in another district. Oh, also, I'm only halfway through. You know more than I do.
Yeah.
Next time we talk, I'm going to let you know how I felt about the end of Twilight. I can't wait. I'm on page 328 of like 400, 500 something, and nothing has happened yet. Can't wait for nothing to happen until I'm done. Honestly, if you need a sleeping pill, just crack open Twilight.
I'm going to confess something to you. I haven't even seen the third movie of Twilight.
You're missing out. They are such nonsense.
Yeah.
My favorite one was the last one, because it's one of the worst. I'm not this kind of person. Like, I don't hate watch stuff. But it was an actual delight seeing Breaking Dawn Part 2 in theaters, because the audience was just all there for the same reason. And just having the time of their lives, myself included, and I would do it again.
That's hilarious.
But I also, like, I don't know what Stephanie Meyers could possibly do from Edward's perspective to make me understand what he was doing any better.
Yeah, I
put those scissors down.
This is terrible, but I'm gonna comp to it anyway. I don't even have any interest in reading this new book. I feel like I'm going to get cornered into it so that we can talk about it on this podcast.
Yeah.
But I have zero interest in reading this book. Someone's going to have to give me a copy because I'm not spending any money on it.
That's fair. I think maybe see if they'll send you an ARC.
I'm sure there will be ARCs of this book. That will definitely happen.
Yes, absolutely. Tell them, like, we love it. Tell them to listen to our podcast. Just mute the parts where you're talking.
Let's be honest. Stephanie Meyer and Curtis Sittenfeld are never coming on our podcast because we've been really mean.
I hope to God that I write a book and people can be mean about it on a podcast.
Yeah.
So anyway, if you're listening and you have a book that came to your mind when we were talking about this that very specifically didn't meet your expectations, let us know. Reach out to us. We're book people, so like we'll be nice. Like we talking about this stuff. Jill and I love each other, even though we think each other's opinions are garbage.
True story.
Okay. Well, bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Book It, a bi-weekly podcast. If you're interested in learning more or donating to the Blue Manatee Literacy Project, you can find us online at bluemanatee.org. If you're in Cincinnati, come by and see us. We're located at 3094 Madison Road in Oakley.